On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Evaluating LNAPL Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover introductory material very quickly today and then turn the training over to our trainers. Today's training is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance, Evaluating LNAPL Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals. We're going to introduce you to this guidance during today's training, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's class. Our training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover. We're scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording today's session. During today's class, trainers control the slides. If you want to, you can go to that CLUIN training page where you started today and download the presentation. We do look for your questions throughout today's training. In the Q&A box in the lower right, you can send in those questions. We'll have question and answer breaks in the middle and at the end of today's class. At the end of today's training, we do ask that everyone on the call take just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We really do use the information that you provide. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate for attending today's training class. More information about ITRC is on the website. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of State, and overall, it's a network that's led by state regulators, includes our federal partners, members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC uses policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. I'll introduce our trainers for today. Eric Gessert is the supervisor of the Petroleum Remediation Program for the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. He focuses on incorporating state-of-the-science technologies into the program, including advanced characterization techniques and conceptual site model developments. Ian Hertz is a senior associate engineer with Golder Associates, located in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's a technical specialist in the areas of LNAPL and DNAPL source characterization, monitored natural attenuation, vapor intrusion, and vapor phase in-situ remediation technologies. Rick Ahlers is a technical expert with Arcadius in San Diego, California. He has worked on sites ranging from service stations to refineries. I'll now turn the presentation over to Eric Gessert at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Eric?
All right. Thank you for the introduction, Juliana, and thank you for everyone that is attending. Was happy to see with one of the initial poll questions that you would put up about how many of the previous internet-based training offerings had people attended, that it looked like the majority of people had actually taken the Part 1 and Part 2 LNAPL internet-based trainings that were offered over the previous 2 weeks. So this is, of course, the third and final offering, or the third part in the series of LNAPL ITRC internet-based trainings. And today we are going to pick up where we left off. We're going to go over remedial objectives. Defining those objectives, we're going to give an overview of the remedial technologies that the ITRC document reviews for the purpose of using to abate LNAPL concerns. We're going to go through that selection process, and then we are going to sort of give an overview of how to utilize the technical guidance. So the guidance that I am referring to is the ITRC LNAPL Technical / Regulatory Guidance, which came out in December of 2009, and the title of that document was Evaluating LNAPL Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals. This is a widely used document, I would say, and has been very beneficial in helping helping state agencies and helping consultants, regulators, people with vested interests in sites that have LNAPL kind of, identify what are the next steps. It does a good job of introducing the framework for implementing LNAPL remediation, a framework for technology selection, and lots of hands-on tools that kind of guide us to ask, questions that, critical questions that need to be answered. Essentially, the next 10 or so slides that I'm going to be going over are a bit of an overview of the previous two trainings. So for those of you who were in those trainings, this should be just a quick 10-minute, kind of summary to, to refresh that. And for those of you who have not been in there, it, will briefly introduce what all we covered. So let's talk about goals. This team that put together that 2009 training, or that 2009 guidance document, these were some of the goals that they wanted to achieve when they went about the task of creating this guidance. One of them was to have an objective-driven technology selection process, which is incredibly important. I'm sure a lot of people can recall the times when LMAPL appeared at a site and we simply knew that we had to do something, so we went about doing something, but we didn't really define what was the objective that we had. Another highlight, another goal that this team had going into it was just the understanding that we really need to have a specific and sound LMAPL conceptual site model. So how do we go about addressing these goals that we had identified? The original ITRC LMAPL team was formed in July of 2007, and the big thing to sort of take away from this slide is that it was a collaborative effort. It involved regulators, stakeholders, federal stakeholders, as well as industry and consulting representatives, and I've said it a lot of times in these internet-based trainings, but that is probably one of, that really leads to why ITRC is successful, is that it is a collaborative effort where people who are involved with having to address these concerns are all sitting at the table, and we're able to understand each other's viewpoints as we, look to identify acceptable solutions. So why was there the focus on LMAPL? As I'm sure a lot of you are aware, LMAPL is at thousands of sites, and typically when it does manifest itself in a monitoring well, it leads to, it leads to sort of longer-term solutions. If you look at the last, let's see, all right, I brought the arrow in. Really looking at this last bullet here, promote a holistic consideration of LMAPL in the context of the overall site corrective action objectives. And then it states, address the LMAPL disconnect in Rebecca states. And there certainly was a disconnect because when LMAPL was present, we weren't really looking at the specific concerns that were associated with the LMAPL. We just knew that we did not really want for LMAPL to be in wells or on the site, and so it became quite a regulatory barrier to achieve closure. So the LMAPL team that came together in 2007 produced two documents. One of those documents is largely the one that is the basis for this training, and that is entitled LMAPL 2, the Remedial Technologies for Achieving Project Goals. It also produced a specific document on natural source zone depletion, created this three-part internet-based training, which has been ongoing since 2010, consecutively, I believe, from 2010 through 2017. Classroom training was ongoing from, I believe, 2011 through 2016. Over a dozen different trainings were offered throughout the United States, and it was, again, a pretty successful class. And most recently, and myself and the other trainers today, we are on this current ITRC team, which is the LMAPL update team, which started in 2006. Essentially, we will be incorporating the teachings and the information in the first two technical documents, but we're going to expound a bit more upon some other relevant LNAPL topics and also move the guidance into the web-based format that ITRC has adopted over the past handful of years. So talking about regulatory context a little bit, one of the biggest challenges that that has been present with dealing with LNAPL is that definition of maximum extent practicable. And states can interpret that differently. Common definitions that had been observed over the years were, you know, removing it to a measured thickness in a well, typically an eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch, removing it to a sheen. There were some risk-based drivers for how do we remove it to the maximum extent practicable. Happy to say that, you know, nearly 10 years after the initial team was formed and the initial documents were put out, that a lot more implementing agencies are having a risk-based approach to addressing LNAPL. And that is, in our opinion, a much better approach than the sort of measured thickness. And the way that we got to there was really by looking at, well, what are the specific concerns that we have when we identify LNAPL at a site? And ITRC broadly breaks those concerns down into two groups. We have compositional-based concerns and saturation-based concerns. Composition-based concerns typically deal with vapor phase or dissolve phase, and the LNAPL body can be a continuous source of those vapor phase or dissolve phase concerns. Saturation concerns, we're concerned with LNAPL mobility. You know, if LNAPL is moving through the subsurface, it obviously has the potential to, to get into contact with sensitive environments or points of exposure that, you know, we do not desire for it to be in contact with. Another saturation-based concern we identify as visible aesthetics, and that largely is LNAPL in a well, and how do we address that? Stepping back a tiny bit, this is sort of what cleanup efforts looked like prior to the introduction of a sound technology selection framework, which is what we're going to be addressing today. But it's pretty much the standard. We have LNAPL in the well. We know we need to do something, so we're going to do something. But we didn't really identify what were those specific concerns that we had, and so years would go by and money would be expended. But because we never really defined the problem that we had, we still had a problem. In the LNAPL 2 guidance document that identifies that selection framework, this is sort of the first figure that was put in there. And the update team is working on, you know, we are updating this figure, but it still generally holds true. You have LNAPL at a site, and so first question is, well, do we have composition-based concerns, or do we have saturation-based concerns? If you have a composition concern, do we want to address the LNAPL directly, or do we want to address the composition components that we're concerned with? If we have saturation concerns, do we need to actively manage those saturation concerns, or does long-term stewardship come into play? This sort of simple flowchart really helps incorporate those concerns and drivers that I identified in the previous slide. So overall, what this three-part internet-based training is really trying to focus on, and what the LNAPL 2 guidance document that was put out in 2009 tried to address, was promoting principles that facilitate timely and successful LNAPL remediation. Specifically looking at the development of a good conceptual site model, making sure that key concepts are understood before we get into this too far, and then really looking at the concerns, objectives, technology screening process that is introduced. And ideally, this provides a good framework, so if you have a seat at the table at an LNAPL site, you are well informed, and ideally the people that you're in the room with that are there to make decisions with you they hopefully are well informed as well, and that's really the best that we can hope for. So this is a pretty nice slide which identifies the concerns a little bit more visually, and it further identifies how well our regulations do at addressing these concerns. If we look at what's identified as these sort of number one concerns, emergency issues dealing, that are the results of an LNAPL release, our regulations do a pretty good job at. We know that we need to, immediately abate explosive conditions. When we get into dissolve phase or vapor phase concerns, our regulations, again, have pretty specific endpoints about what we're trying to achieve. Typically, when you have dissolve phase concerns, the endpoint that you're trying to get to is some sort of maximum contaminant level, and or maybe it's a site-specific target level, but it's a concentration that we have comfort in knowing that a point of exposure is not going to be impacted by this contaminant plume. And same goes for vapor intrusion. Now would be a good time to note that, LNAPL as a light non-aqueous phase liquid directly results in the production of petroleum vapors. And ITRC in October of 2014, I believe, put out a specific petroleum vapor intrusion guidance document, which, again, helps us better understand what are the real concerns, what are the best way to go about assessing these petroleum vapor issues. What our regulations historically have not done a great job of addressing is 4 and 5 as identified here, assessing LNAPL potential mobility, as well as what do we do when LNAPL shows up into a well. And those are the LNAPL saturation concerns. So let's talk about saturation just a little bit. I'm actually going to start at the third condition, which LNAPL saturation is less than residual saturation. And essentially what that means is LNAPL is within the pore space of the, it's in the soil pore space, but it doesn't have enough driving head to really mobilize itself into the subsurface or to even have enough driving head to appear in a monitoring well. However, we need to acknowledge that LNAPL within the pore space below residual saturation is still a concern because it can be a consistent source of compositional issues. If you have a vapor issue that you're needing to address, you should have in the back of your mind that, well, I haven't seen LNAPL in a well, but I have this persistent vapor issue. I'm wondering if there are high enough concentrations, percent saturations of LNAPL that I might need to actively address that. Same goes towards dissolve phase concerns. The second condition is LNAPL saturation is greater than residual, and we call this mobile LNAPL, meaning that mobile LNAPL essentially, it has enough of a driving head to appear in a monitoring well, largely because it's able to overcome the pore entry pressures to get into the granular packing of the well, but it does not have enough of a driving head to be what we call migrating LNAPL. And migrating LNAPL means that it has enough driving head to continue to move through the subsurface. So it's important to kind of have a concept of mobile migrating and residual. Another key concept that we need to understand is the non-uniform distribution of LNAPL. The big thing that I would like for people to take away from this slide, this is depicting LNAPL saturation above the LNAPL water interface. And this is sort of a generic model, and this is some field-specific data that was pulled from a lot of different sites. But what it's depicting is even at the highest saturation observed, LNAPL in the pore space was only at 50% saturation in the pore space, meaning that it shared the rest of that pore space with water and or air. So the big thing to take away when we think about LNAPL in the subsurface is not that it is a continuous unit that's moving through the subsurface, but more that it is sharing the pore spaces with water and or air, and that it never really is at 100% continuous saturation in a pore. So we're going to get into objectives a bit more, but we're going to talk just a tiny bit about saturation objectives and composition objectives in the next two slides here. So when we have a saturation objective, our LMAPL concern is typically a mobility concern. And ITRC identified three broad groupings, remedial groupings, that further help us understand what is it that we're trying to achieve. But the remedial solution when we have a saturation-based objective is typically a mass recovery solution or a mass control or stabilization solution. Whereas when we have a composition-based objective, we're largely concerned with the risk, the vapor or dissolve phase risk. And so the type of remedial solution that we're going to come up with is called a phase change solution, where we are trying to, you know, lessen the specific chemicals of concern within the LMAPL to reduce that risk. The last slide that I'm going to present to you before I turn it over to Ian is just understanding that managing LMAPL, or really managing any cleanup site, is an iterative process. We start by characterizing, getting good characterization information, which then feeds into that conceptual site model. When we have a sound enough conceptual site model, we can then start getting into the LMAPL management aspects of it. But we always need to be understanding, do I have an adequate amount of characterization? Is the way that the LMAPL is cleaning up, is it consistent with what our expectations were? I think someone just jumped on. Oh, Ian might have jumped on. Sorry. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Ian with Golder, and he's going to start giving an overview of the remedial technologies.
Thank you very much, Eric. Can everyone hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to now transition into the remedial technology overview, and we're going to follow a number of tables and concepts that were introduced in the 2009 guidance and are currently being updated. So we're starting with the 17 LMAPL remedial technologies that were identified and were carried through the guidance with respect to their characteristics, and Rick is going to lead us through the more detailed evaluation process. I'm going to just provide the introduction. So there are obviously a range of technologies from simple to more complex. Part of the new group is they're doing is adding a few new technologies. And so, again, this is a really comprehensive source of information that hopefully will be useful for your remedial evaluations. I'd like to link the primary mechanism and technology, and that's done in Table 5.1. And we have four different categories in terms of the way the technology works. First of all, we have LMAPL mass recovery, where, for example, if you're excavating, you're removing mass. But also, if you're skimming or removing product from wells or multi-phase extraction, and these technologies focus on mass removal. The second is phase change remediation. And here we're exploiting characteristics of the contaminant, where, for example, if there is partitioning from a aqueous to a gas phase, and we use a technology such as air sparging or solvic or extraction, we can introduce or cause there to be compositional change as well as mass recovery. Natural source zone depletion is the simplest passive technology, but it's a very important one. There's a lot more emphasis in the guidance on that technology. We also like to draw your attention to guidance that ITRC developed back in 2009. The third type of primary mechanism is LMAPL mass control. And here's where we are physically containing, for example, a plume, or perhaps an apple, an apple zone. Or there's a stabilization where we're mixing in chemical reagents to stabilize that contaminant source zone. And then finally, there's phase change remediation and mass recovery. So here we may actually introduce a surfactant to change the characteristics, perhaps increase the mobility of the L-NAPL, or perhaps the dissolved phase concentrations. But we're also trying to achieve mass recovery. And so these are typically more aggressive technologies that aren't used at a lot of sites, but certainly there's interest in these technologies. There's the concept of multiple treatment technologies or trains. And I think that's an important concept you should consider at sites. So you may start with dual pump liquid extraction or perhaps even skimming. You may consider air sparging and solid vapor extraction to perhaps achieve a compositional goal or remove some more mass. And then finally, NSCD, I think, is a highly effective technology for continued biodegradation and mass loss. So the linkage between these remediation objectives that Eric introduced in the primary mechanism is important to understand. So if we're thinking about the saturation objective, again, mass recovery, we're trying to reduce the L-NAPL saturation by recovering the L-NAPL mass, again, through technologies such as product recovery. The compositional objective, this is primarily phase change remediation, trying to change the L-NAPL characteristics by the phase change. And then the containment objective, where we're controlling the L-NAPL mass. I'm going to, in a few instances, actually go back to part one of the training. I think these concepts are really important. And this one shows the classic shark fin with the L-NAPL saturation as a function of depth. And we have that residual saturation line. On the right-hand side, we have mobile and potentially recoverable L-NAPL. And the key point is that if we're looking at technologies where we're trying to, for example, recover L-NAPL and reduce mass, we're only going to be successful where we have actual mobile L-NAPL. And so again, it's very important to understand your site characteristics and not go down the road of planning and implementing expensive technologies for example, again, mass recovery if there isn't significant mobile L-NAPL present. The other concept that is being looked at more frequently is the sustainability of technologies, and particularly the linkage to NSCD and the rates that you may actually see naturally occurring relative to those that can be achieved with more active remedial technologies. This slide here is, actually Eric touched on this in the different distribution of the L-NAPL. On the right-hand side, it's the L-NAPL body is shown there with higher saturations in the core. There's potential for migration and spreading, however, at the periphery, the edges of that L-NAPL body. The L-NAPL pressure is less than the pore entry pressure. And that can be linked on the left-hand side to that relative permeability plot, where as the L-NAPL saturation increases, the relative permeability of that L-NAPL increases, and we have that inverse relationship with water. So a key point, again, is that you may have a site with some mobile L-NAPL present in wells, but you will often have, and again, this is covered in part one of the training, a overall stable L-NAPL body, which should be considered when making remedial decisions. Moving on to the compositional objective, this is actually provided by Rick, and it shows some very nice data, the result of soil vapor extraction, where the composition with respect to TPH concentrations in soil changed over time as a result of soil vapor extraction that occurred for about a four-year time period. And you can see, it's quite obvious from the figure, that the ligand is significantly removed and reduced relative to the heavier molecular weight hydrocarbons. It's also shown is that there is a decrease in the mass as well. So, and solvate for extraction can also be a technology to remove mass. This slide here shows the equilibrium benzene concentration relative to L-methyl saturation. And we're starting at kind of a one point A where the L-methyl saturation is about 0.3. The benzene concentration is about 11 milligrams per liter. If we reduce the saturation through perhaps removal of L-methyl from wells, and consequently over time we reduce the L-methyl saturation, we may see very little change in the benzene concentration in groundwater. And the reason for that is studies have shown in modeling by Huntley and others that a significant portion of the source needs to be removed before seeing significant declines in groundwater concentrations. And there's some different models to try to estimate that. There's the LMAS model and the RemFuel model, but conceptually I think this does hold, that you do need to remove a significant portion of that mass. However, if you can change the composition, as shown in C there, through some other types of technologies, you may actually achieve a reduction in your groundwater concentration. So if that's important, I think this, you know, the concepts as linked to technologies are very important to understand. Moving on to Table 5.2 in the guidance, and here's where we start to link remedial technologies to site-specific LNAPL and site conditions. We discussed the pros and cons of technologies, the applicable geology, coarse grain, fine grain, the applicable LNAPL type with respect to certain technologies may not be suitable for heavier molecular weight LNAPL, for example. The remedial objective and then time frame is all linked back to the 17 technologies. So many of these technologies modify or exploit a particular LNAPL characteristic. In some cases, it's transmissivity if you're pumping. In some cases, volatility if you're looking at, for example, soil vapor extraction. And in other cases, it may be the biodegradation characteristics, for example, bioventing. So all these technologies, it's really important to understand how they act and how they are linked to your site-specific conditions. So let's review some key conditions here. The next slide is this is actually something we just wanted to interject with, is the importance of not only understanding your site and LNAPL conditions, but also understanding perhaps other factors. There may be overriding factors with respect to your project objectives, with respect to perhaps timelines, or there may be access or certain constraints that you need to consider. And then also, you may consider testing and modeling and pilot testing. And so, we don't want to necessarily oversimplify the process, and we just want to make sure that you understand that there's all these things that go into the hopper, so to speak, and then finally, that's all considered with respect to technology selection. But back to the site considerations, site conditions, some are listed there. Depth to water table, for example, could be important for a technology such as multi-phase extraction, where if you get to significant depths, you may have to adjust your technology to overcome that potential depth limitation. With respect to the LNAPL conditions, I've already mentioned biodegradation. With respect to bioventing, viscosity is another example we could just touch on, which are the obvious one. If you have highly viscous product, you're going to have maybe some challenges with respect to product recovery and perhaps different technologies or pumps that you would need to use relative to more or less viscous product. So again, important to understand all these different factors. At this point, we're going to transition and just touch on a few technologies as examples. Of course, we cannot cover the full range of all the 17 technologies and how they work, and so it's always a balance here, and certainly we're just going to touch on some highlights and illustrate the mechanism and then some of the advantages and disadvantages. So excavation is an obvious one, mass recovery. The advantages include short timelines, complete mass removal in some cases. Disadvantages, of course, access, depth, and then sustainability. I think with respect to large excavations, safety, trucking of soil, perhaps long distances to disposal facilities. This example is a site that we worked on. The important lesson here was that in this case, I don't think that the site was that well characterized, and there was perhaps a lack of understanding of the distribution of LMAPL, which extended below the water table, fairly large release. And we know through displacement pressures and also fluctuating water tables that in many cases we'll see LMAPL below the water table. And so if that's not accounted for in your planning and you go excavate, you think that you've potentially going to remove all the LMAPL and it goes deeper, that can cause some significant challenges. So in this case, we're able to go deeper and dewater the excavation, but became a fairly large and costly undertaking. So the next technology is NFPD, and this is something I'm really active in and I'm very excited about, because I think we're really starting to understand more about these processes. We have bedostone processes for lateralization and aerobic biodegradation. We have saturated zone processes for dissolution, also biodegradation. We're understanding more and more that the anaerobic processes in the saturated zone can be important. And so there are some key factors with composition, the volatility with respect to at least that process, and of course the solubility and biodegradation rates, and a lot of ongoing research and work. And that's going to be, I think, really well incorporated in the new guidance. So just stay tuned for that. There will be much more emphasis and data to support NFCD. It's a low-intensity solution. Advantages are, you know, some of them are obvious. You know, it's passive, limited, no disruption. There may be sustainability advantages. Of course, you know, the downside is that certainly it's a longer-term solution, and if you haven't addressed perhaps the risk factors fully, or there's potential for mobile LMAPL that may spread, you obviously want to look at active technologies first. So often this is a more of a polishing type of technology. So next is the barrier wall. Some key considerations are things like your soil type, your depth below grade and access, and whether you need to deal with both the unsaturated and saturated zone. We've been involved in a few projects like this where site constraints being really important, but the basic concept here is that you're going to, in this case here, create a trench. You're going to fill it with water that contains some bentonite to keep that trench open, and then you're going to backfill with a bentonite soil mixture. And you may want to key that into an underlying confined unit, or perhaps that's a hanging wall if it's LMAPL. Certainly there's many technologies out there, cutter head, pretty advanced technologies for adding amendments and mixing bentonite and constructing deep walls. In some cases, that's perhaps warranted if it's close to a sensitive receptor or water body, concerns about movement into maybe that kind of environment. The disadvantages are, you know, it's a containment solution, often will require groundwater pumping, upgrading of the wall, so ongoing management and potentially costly. Next is we're going to move to phase change and air sparging and soil vapor extraction. Just a basic point, air sparging addresses contaminants below the water table, soil vapor extraction above the water table. This is a physical mechanism, the complementary technologies that address bio or focus on biodegradation are biosparging and bioventing. And there are some potentially significant differences in the way you would implement your technologies. Bioventing, for example, you may inject air at relatively low flow rates to match the biodegradation demand. You may do different types of testing as compared to soil vapor extraction, which exploits the volatility and is more suited for releases such as gasoline, whereas a bioventing would be more appropriate for diesel, perhaps heavier molecular weight hydrocarbons. Some of the key conditions are in the composition and volatility, but also the permeability. Soil vapor extraction becomes more challenged. Certainly can be considered for finer grain deposits, but it's not going to be nearly as efficient. And there may be some ways to overcome those limitations, but that is an important point. The advantages of this technology, potential compositional changes can be achieved, and there can be some mass recovery. Again, it's a technology that, depending on how it's implemented, would have, I would consider, sort of moderate waste concerns, and certainly you probably need to treat, if you're using soil vapor extraction, your air emissions, but that may be less intensive treatment as compared to some other technologies where you may have, you know, product and water and air phase treatment systems needed. And so that, I just want to point out, it's important consideration for technology selection is how do you deal with those waste streams. Moving on, this is just a quick example of some modeling I did at a site where we're looking at soil vapor extraction, and we use a computational code called Airflow SVE, and it's simply just to help optimize the design, and we looked at a barrier at surface to improve the radius of influence. The point here is really is that the pore flushings were critical. So close to that well, we had fairly quick cleanup. As you move deeper and further away from the well, you get to a much slower cleanup. And so important to understand factors like radius of influence and your pore flushings, and if you're really trying to achieve a certain goal. And there are tools out there that can be used in some cases to improve the design. Next slide is LMAPL mass recovery. Here is where, at least on this slide, we're just focusing on relatively simple hydraulic methods. And that can be anything from skimming to dual pump to multi-phase extraction type recovery. These technologies are typically, the goal is to address saturation and often the potential for mobile LMAPL to migrate, so we want to reduce that. The advantage are often, you know, at least early on, significant recovery. And I think, you know, there are certainly trade-offs between less intensive skimming, passive methods, and more active or intensive methods, and really that comes down to a site-specific evaluation on what technology is you know, best suited for your site conditions. It's really critical here to understand part two of the training and transmissivity, a really important concept to help in the design. Disadvantages include just dealing with your residuals and some possibly cost. Here is a slide that goes back to part one of the training and the importance of understanding the specific volume, how much LMAPL you have in the formation. What we're showing here is the pancake model, which is, of course, we don't use anymore. It overestimates the amount of LMAPL. And then we have the gravel, silt, and medium sand, all with varying specific volumes estimated from this vertical equilibrium model. Key point is, have you considered sort of the effect of soil type and the amount of LMAPL that you may have in formation, and how does that match with your technology? Of course, the other point that I just made is absolutely critical, is the linkage to transmissivity. Now, just this slide here, I'm not going to really spend time on this because it was already shown, but I think the importance is to understand your site-specific conditions and the potential variability. There's, of course, these additional lines of evidence. I think we find that LIF is a really great tool for trying to understand that distribution, where the LMAP is present, variability. Moving on to the next technology grouping here was our methods, mass recovery and phase change. So the example in the lower left is the shark fin. And here is where we have that residual saturation line. We're potentially going to try to move that to the left there by perhaps adding a surfactant or changing the characteristics of that LMAP or the conditions, the temperature, for example, in the formation. Here's where we typically have some kind of pumping, hydraulic pumping, often for LMAP. We may also, of course, remove the gas phase, especially for introducing heat. You know, the things we can try to do to enhance this are oxidizers, heat, surfactants, or solvents. And so the advantage is greater mass recovery. I think that the significant disadvantage is they have multiple different waste streams to treat, added complexity, and questions on whether the added costs will really result in significant benefit with respect to the ultimate goals of your cleanup. And do you really need to remove mass? Is it going to improve groundwater quality appreciably? Is there other risk drivers that are really not addressed through perhaps less aggressive technology? So there's some real questions here again, and then there's sustainability. There's, again, I mentioned there's interest in these technologies, but not as common as the other approaches already described. This is an example of six-phase heating. There's also conduction heating. The key conditions here are the saturation, certainly the LMAP and the composition, volatility. There's also moisture content. You don't want to let the soils dry out too much because it's less efficient. So there's ways of implementing the technologies to avoid that. The interfacial tensions can be reduced, resulting in increased mass recovery, but you're also simply just removing constituents through volatilization and through vapor extraction. There are models that can be used to predict the radius of influence or the extent of that heat transfer, and so CompFlow was a model that we used for that purpose. And so the advantages, again, more aggressive LMAP recovery, disadvantages are cost and sustainability. This slide here is a nice conceptual model of what happens with respect to different conditions. So if we have a base case, we have relative time of one and relative concentration. If we take a slice of that contamination, dig down to partially remove, we're going to, if we have flowing groundwater through the entire tube there, we're going to change that concentration by half. But the relative time may not change it much at all. If we now partially remove contamination in one area right down to the basic contamination, here's where we actually have no change in the relative concentration, but the relative time, because groundwater is flowing through a shortened path and consequently over, you know, there's less time needed to remove those constituents through dissolution. And then finally, if we remove or reduce the saturation by 20%, we're going to, you know, decrease the relative time. So I think this the advantage of this is just conceptually it kind of helps us understand how different types of remediation could result in changes in concentrations. Certainly, it's simplification and probably needs a bit more work to in terms of the new guidance to explain. Provide basis for this, but again, this is a great concept, at least as a starting point. So with that, we're going to move on to a summary. It's really important to understand those basic mechanisms for your technologies and how they link to saturation and compositional objectives. and we summarize the characteristics of remedial technologies with respect to site conditions and LNAPL conditions, and then went through some key technologies with respect to these characteristics. And with that, I'm going to stop. We're going to stop for a question and answer break.
Thanks, Ian. Anyone is welcome to type in questions in that box in the lower right, the Q&A box. While we're doing this question and answer break, we're going to have a quiz for everyone in the audience. So I have it currently set, so you're not going to see everybody's answers yet. So we just talked about some of the technologies. So our quiz here on the left, what general technology groups, and you can pick more than one, would you use when the concern is LNAPL sheen on the surface water body and the objective is to stop LNAPL migration? And you can select more than one here. And then on the right, what general technology groups would you use when the concern is LNAPL is causing vapor intrusion risk and the objective is to reduce or eliminate vapor intrusion risk? And again, you get to select all that apply there. So we'll give you a few minutes to answer those poll questions, and then we'll broadcast the results and let you see what people have said. Anyone is welcome to send in questions, and again, it's that Q&A pod in the lower right. And I also want to remind you at this point, before you wrap up today, we do ask that you fill out the feedback form. So in the related links, that fourth item down is the feedback. And remember, you select the name, and then you look down and select Browse To. We do ask that everyone on the call fill out the feedback form at the end of today's training class. This is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's class. So if you'd like a certificate of attendance for today's training, the way to get that right now is only through the feedback form. So be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate. If you forget to check the box, no problem. Just go back, check the box again, because right now the only way to get that is by checking that box and filling out the feedback form. We did have a question that came in during the first half of today's training. What technology is recommended to a residual LNAPL that for years has been less than 3 inches?
Sure, I fully understand the question with respect to 3 inches of LNAPL in a well. So that's
an
apparent, apparent thickness of 3 inches. It's been around that thickness for years. That you'd want to try to understand the reasons why it's more variable than that. It's kind of ephemeral. It sometimes goes away and then it appears, and particularly when we've been removing LNAPL from the well for some period of time. At that point, I think you want to kind of stop and evaluate what the appropriate next steps are. Partly it may depend on your jurisdiction and the acceptance of risk-based methods and also requirements for removal of LNAPL in wells. If there's the possibility of a risk-based approach where you can look at your vapor risk, you can look at your groundwater risk, and then also mobility, if you've demonstrated that through other lines of evidence. And of course, the thickness metric is not a great one, so we really want to look at other factors that we covered in part one of the training. At that point, then I think you're in a good position then to look at further technologies. And often the hydraulic recovery at that point is not efficient anymore. You probably have come to some asymptotic limit, and you really are dealing with mostly residual. And that residual mass can be relatively significant, but again, there may be, if you've controlled the risks, there may be no real strong or compelling reasons for significant active remediation, but there may be some cost-effective ways of enhancing bio. I think that's where a lot of the trends are, the recent interest is going, perhaps even back to bioventing. Technology has been around for a long time. Cell vapor extraction, maybe sparging. Can you reduce some further mass? But you also want to look at NSCD rates and then make an informed decision on, what's sort of the ultimate goals and needs with respect to remediation. So sorry, that's a long answer. It's often, it is quite complex, and there's a number of caveats and factors to consider, but hopefully that's helpful.
Thank you. A comment has come in. Although we do not consider a sheen as LNAPL, there has to be measurable natural attenuation when there's a sheen. Any comments from trainers?
Rick, do you want to? I know you've looked a lot at sheens. Considered that? Or?
Yeah, sure. So certainly what Ian was talking about earlier with natural source zone depletion is going on. When a sheen occurs, it's because there is some amount of NAPL in the pore space. So that NAPL is there. It's naturally attenuating. It's naturally depleting. So just because we're seeing a sheen, say, in a monitoring well or on a surface water body, doesn't mean there's a tiny bit of NAPL left. You go back to that residual NAPL condition, where there's NAPL trapped in the pore space, that can be a source of composition problems and sheens. So yes, natural attenuation and natural depletion are going on.
Thank you. And to get to our poll questions, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll so that we don't get any more answers, but I will broadcast the results. So for our poll on the left, what general technology groups would you use when the concern is LNAPL sheen on the surface water body, and the objective is to stop the LNAPL migration? And so it looks here like we've got mostly the right answers, because mass control and mass recovery are the answers that we're looking for there. On the next question, I'll go ahead and broadcast these results. What general technology groups would you use when the concern is LNAPL is causing vapor intrusion risk, and the objective is to reduce or eliminate vapor intrusion risk? And the answers we are looking for here is mass control or phase change. So do our trainers want to explain this answer on the right?
I can start with the sheen. That, I think, makes sense with respect to mass control and mass recovery, because there's a significant concern. There's LNAPL. Compositional change or phase change is not going to be a technology that addresses that risk, at least in the short term. And so the mass control is something certainly that if you have a sheen on it in a sediment foreshore area, I mean, that may be the appropriate technology, because you have that direct contact and that pathway is, so to speak, complete. Whereas if you have an upland site where you can go in and recover mass and prevent then that LNAPL from spreading and getting into that foreshore area and causing a sheen on surface water, that so it depends on your site and kind of what you're looking at. So. And that's why I think it's appropriate for both answers to be potentially the correct ones.
Thank you. And did the trainers want to mention the answer on the right?
Either way,
right. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Ian. Okay. When you're looking at a vapor intrusion concern, a vapor intrusion risk, that's being driven by constituents in the LNAPL volatilizing from the LNAPL. Whether it's LNAPL that's mobile and you can see it in wells, or it's LNAPL that's residual and you never see it in wells, it's being driven by that volatilization. So you need to change the composition of the LNAPL to get rid of those volatile chemicals. And so you need a phase change technology.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's the key. I would put sort of an added kind of thought there is, in some cases when you have a direct pathway and depends on, I mean, this would be more applicable for chlorinated solvents where we often see this, but occasionally for petroleum compounds where you need to actually cut off the pathway, so where you need to put in some kind of control. So that's just kind of one of those caveats to occasionally think about.
Another comment has come in from the audience. I would say that surface water sheen application would depend on the type of sheen, hydrocarbon. You can either surround with a boom or let sunlight burn off the rest.
Do you want to address that one, Rick?
I don't disagree. I think the concept we're looking for is how do we prevent the discharge of NAPL to surface water in the first place. So yeah, there's lots of discussion that I've had with others about what is the true risk when you have NAPL discharge to a surface water. But there is the sheen rule, the federal sheen rule, that says that condition of a sheen on the surface water in itself is a problem.
Thank you. We'll continue on now with the second half of the training. You are welcome to send in questions throughout the second half of the training class. We do hope to have time at the end to ask those questions out loud. Also, another reminder, please be sure to fill out that feedback form before you wrap up today. We really do use the information that you provide. I'm going to turn the presentation back over now to Eric Gessert at the Colorado Division of Oil and Public Safety. Eric?
All right. Thank you, Juliana. Good answers, Ian and Rick. I was ready to jump in, but it seemed like you guys had it covered. So before we get into the remedial technology selection framework, which Rick is going to cover in some detail, I'm just going to do a couple of slides which relate to objective setting. So just a handful of slides here. We've introduced the concept, obviously, of concerns, and this was the slide that was earlier in today's presentation, and we talked about the various concerns that we have. Well, what we're now going to introduce is how we relate objectives and goals and metrics with concerns, because it matters when we're talking about having clearly understood endpoints and clearly understood definitions of the problem that we're trying to solve. So this is just broadly, we've got LNAPL concerns and remedial objectives. So if you have a composition-based objective, Ian had introduced the concepts of the technologies in the last section. And so when we have a composition objective, we we want to select a composition-based remedy, and largely those remedies are phase change-based. Where when we have, Ian, I think that you might be on not muted. Then when we have LNAPL saturation concerns, we're probably looking at the technology groupings of mass recovery or mass control. So getting into the concepts and terms that we want for people to understand, and I will say for the purpose of today's presentation, here's how we are defining these things. But an objective is more broad-based. An objective is meant to establish the condition where we will no longer have the concern. So it's the desired state that we want to achieve, so we no longer have the concern. The goal is sort of the specific route that we're going to take to meet that objective. And I'm sure people are more familiar with the term SMART goal or SMART objective, and that is something that as we're developing the update document, we are really reinforcing those concepts of SMART. But we want for our goals to be specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-based. That's one of the acronyms for what a SMART goal is. Performance metrics are a way to really measure, so that metrics are sort of the M of that SMART acronym. How are we measuring this to see if we're achieving the goal? So these are just, some basic terms, but they're important to understand, and they really do relate to the concerns that we've identified. So let's just look at some, just broad examples of what objectives could be. When we have risk-based objectives, we might have an objective for a particular project where we want to reduce the risk level, or we want to eliminate the exposure pathway. non-risk-based objectives, meaning that they're really not vapor or dissolve phase related, may be to reduce the L-MAPL flux, reduce the source size, reduce the transmissivity or thickness in wells. These are some general objectives that as we go through the technology selection process that Rick is going to identify, once we sort of land on a technology, then we can take performance metrics that are specific to that technology and sort of lock in and say, here's how we're going to achieve this general objective of reducing the L-MAPL transmissivity. So let's take a look at an example, or a couple examples, I should say. So when we have a concern of L-MAPL is present in a well, our objective may be to recover the mass to the extent practicable. And again, that's broadly defined. Once we go through the selection process, we'll be a bit more specific. If we have the concern of L-MAPL is sourcing a dissolve phase plume, our objective may be to reduce the soluble fraction, the chemicals of concern within that L-MAPL body, to meet the groundwater quality standards. And lastly, we have the concern of L-MAPL is generating explosive conditions in utility. Well, now we want to reduce the volatile fraction to eliminate that vapor concern. So that's just, you know, these are some loose examples. When Rick walks you through the selection process and sort of utilizes the tools that are identified in the document, you will see that there is a whole column dedicated to this is the concern, this is the objective in that L-MAPL 2 guidance. So here's another example of now we're getting into a goal. And as again, as utilized here, a goal is specifically how are we going to achieve that objective. So if we have the objective of recover L-MAPL mass to the extent practicable, there's multiple goals that we may have, and they're sort of dependent on the technology that we select. We can see the first goal that's identified, L-MAPL removal to residual saturation, and that would be an appropriate goal if you're selecting the technology of dual-phase L-MAPL recovery, where we're wanting to recover the L-MAPL until it essentially is no longer apparent in a well is what this is saying. If we have a goal of complete L-MAPL removal, well, a lot of us know that excavation is the technology of choice if you want complete removal, because typically you draw a box around where your concern exists. This is our targeted treatment area, and if that area is accessible for excavation, excavation is one of the few technologies that can achieve complete removal, assuming that it can excavate the box that you've identified. So moving along, here are some example performance metrics, and it's important to sort of identify the concept of we have a metric, and then we have an endpoint. So here we have the example goal of L-MAPL recovery approaching residual saturation. So the metric that we would use if we are trying to assess the approaching residual saturation is transmissivity. The endpoint that we could look at is a specific either numeric value or here it's a stated range. The L-MAPL 2 document put out in 2009 identified a stated range of 0.1 to 0.8 feet squared per second as sort of a practical limit where hydraulic recovery is not really practical when you are below that range in transmissivity. Other endpoints and metrics we can look at, stabilized dissolve phase plume concentrations, and the metric that we're looking at is the stability of the plume. Another metric when you are doing total fluids recovery might be to look at the water-oil ratio, and it's a good thing to state up front, hey, we're going to run this system until we hit this ratio where it just is not practical. We're pumping too much water relative to how much oil we're getting out. There are other ways to look at that. Looking at it in gallon or dollars per gallon is another example of a metric. So before I turn this over to Rick, I just wanted to sort of reiterate the principles of how we successfully define our problem and define our scope and approach with a cleanup. starts with a good conceptual site model. That conceptual site model makes apparent what your LNAPL concerns are. Once you have those concerns identified, we start matching those with objectives. Then we will walk through the technology selection process, which Rick is about to go into. Once we pick a technology, then we start looking at, well, what are the metrics that we're going to use to achieve the objective and or the goal that we had identified. And as sort of noted at the bottom, failure to complete one of these steps, I'm sure we've all been involved in projects that are, you know, a couple decades old. And if we look at how things were done in the, you know, initial steps of that project, you know, if I were a betting person, I would say that one of these steps was not appropriately followed. And so it just leads to, you know, more money and more time. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rick Ahlers of Arcadis.
Thanks, Eric. Yeah, so just to hammer home what Eric was just saying, what we're trying to do with the next few slides that I'm going to talk about is give you an example process to follow so that you're considering all of this information you have and all of this training you've gotten, not only from today, but from the past two sessions. So you want to be able to take all of that LNAPL science information you have, how to think about setting remedial objectives, and how to think about how technologies work, and put it all together in a systematic way so that you can choose the right technologies and figure out when you're done using those technologies. So here's a nice flowchart that's going to help us put this all together. I'm an engineer. I really love flowcharts. It always keeps my mind on what the next step is and if I've completed the previous step. So the flowchart that's showing here, we're going to use throughout the rest of the presentation, and it's going to be used to remind everyone where we are in the guidance document. The information in the boxes outlined in blue has already been covered, mainly in Internet-based training part two, but also earlier in today's training. And that information sets the stage for selecting a remedial technology. The next two boxes after that, labeled section six on the right there, are the first steps in the selection process, and they're probably the most important steps. They're going to be selecting a technology based on the objectives and goals and the LNAPL conditions, and then screening those technologies against some basic site geology. So a picture on the lower right there, this is an AST during routine turnaround. Hole was found in the bottom there. You can see it's about the size of a quarter. And you know that led to the sort of problem that we have to resolve by using this process. So the next section of the LNAPL guidance document in section 7 covers the additional evaluation factors that you're going to consider as you continue to screen remedial technologies. In some feasibility studies, these are called balancing factors. And then section 8 covers testing and data collection that may be necessary for final remedy selection or remedy design. And then lastly, those last three boxes, they really cover a key step when implementing a remedial technology. They let you know when you're going to be able to stop remediation or application of a particular technology, a particular remedial technology. So by establishing those remedial goals and metrics and monitoring your remedial performance, you know when you've achieved the goal for that particular remedy. So I want to make a key point here that this is a stepwise process, but at any time you want to think about, do you have enough information to make the decisions you're making and to go to the next step? And if you don't, if you identify data gaps, then at any point you can circle back up to the top, build that LNAPL conceptual model a little better, maybe rethink about your LNAPL concerns. And the other thing, this process is really, the goal of this process is to identify an active remedy. So if we're just looking for a passive NAPL management at a site, then this really isn't the right process to follow. So now let's start in on that section 6. So Ian earlier showed us those 17 technologies. The first step of the process, the goal of the first step of the process, is to pare down that list of 17 technologies to maybe 5 or so technologies that might be applicable at our site. So this is a two-step process to pare those technologies. This is the first step of screening technologies. First, we're going to look at what the remedial objectives and goals and metrics are for those technologies, identify what technology group we're looking at, and then screen the technologies that are in the table that I'll show you in a few slides down according to some basic site conditions. Then we're going to look at more detailed site conditions, more detailed geologic factors, and those are given in the A series tables in the appendix specific for each technology, and that's going to help us screen those technologies even more. So then on slide 62 here, we're going to take our first look at table 6.1, and this is in the body of the guidance document. So what I'm going to do on the next 5 slides is gradually walk through column by column, table 6.1. So we start on the left-hand side, and we're going to look at the remedial objectives. So for this particular row that I've extracted out of table 6.1, the remedial objective we're looking at is to reduce the LNAPL saturation when it's above the residual range, and that means that LNAPL is mobile, it can flow into wells. So other objectives that you'll find in this table when you go look in the guidance document are to reduce the LNAPL mass and mobility, or terminate LNAPL body expansion. The graphic down on the right there is a skimmer system, and it's going to help us address two different kinds of objectives. It might help us address reducing the LNAPL mass and mobility, or it might help us address, aesthetic LNAPL concerns, just the fact that LNAPL is in wells. So then we move to the second column here, the LNAPL remedial goal. What we want to do here is really hone in on what we're hoping the technology we're going to apply is going to be able to do. And so the statement here is to reduce the recoverable LNAPL to the extent practicable. And we talked a little bit about how you could define that earlier. It might be a transmissivity metric. Other remedial goals that you might have would be to abate LNAPL body expansion, abate toxic vapors, or change the composition, remove a sufficient soluble mass fraction from the LNAPL to reduce the dissolved phase flux. So if you look down there in the bottom right again, the example, this is a graphic from an experiment, a laboratory experiment at Colorado State University. There was a well put in there and some artificial porous media, and then LNAPL was introduced, and the LNAPL is dyed red so you can see it. And you can see that in the upper right of that, let me pull up a pointer here. In the upper right, you can see that there's mobile LNAPL in the formation, and that LNAPL can flow into the well or flow out of the well. But there's also some LNAPL down here in the bottom right. You can just barely see some pink coloring here, and that's LNAPL. That's not dissolved phase, that's not absorbed phase, but it's residual LNAPL that's in the formation. And no matter how much we pump the LNAPL from the well here, that LNAPL down there is residual, and we're not going to change the saturation of that LNAPL. So that LNAPL can continue to be a source of dissolved phase concerns, even after we've pumped all the LNAPL out of the well. So then we move over here to column 3, the technology group. So we've identified that we want to reduce mobile LNAPL saturation, and we want to reduce it to the maximum extent practicable. So now we know we need to use an LNAPL mass recovery technology. So that's the particular technology group for this concern, for this objective and goal. As we discussed before, other technology groups include mass control and compositional change. And you can see that, again, in the graphic down on the right there, we've got a sheet pile wall, and that's a mass control technology. And then in those sheds there, the repurposed outhouses, are skimmer systems, and that's a mass recovery technology. So then we go to the fourth column, which are example performance metrics that you might use to measure your progress toward that remedial goal, toward that endpoint when you can stop using your technology. So in this case, we're going to, again, use a mass recovery technology, and we want to come to an asymptotic performance of the recovery system. So examples might be looking at just the recovery overall to get to some asymptote, look at the water-oil ratio in what you're pumping from those wells, look at the dollars per gallon of LNAPL removed, and that's that graphic down there on the bottom right again. So here we're seeing a couple of different lines. First, the green line is the LNAPL recovery rate. So starts pretty high initially, and over the first year or so, it drops precipitously, but we're getting pretty good recovery there. But then after that, we're really getting to an asymptotic recovery rate. If we then look at what it costs per year or per 10 years to recover that gallon, a gallon of LNAPL, and we'd consider in that the cost of the total system plus the O&M costs and any repair costs that you'd have over that time period. So it starts out at a pretty reasonable rate of about $20 a gallon, but gradually climbs up. And as our recovery rate gets smaller and smaller, that 10-year cost per gallon goes up. So these are two different metrics that you might use to decide when that skimmer system has done enough. So lastly, as you work across table 6.1 and you get to the fifth column, what you're going to have is the technologies that might apply. So you might apply what we call dual pump liquid extraction, also called total fluids extraction. You might use multi-phase extraction to get LNAPL from the wells. You know, and there are a number of other technologies that when you look at that table in the guidance are there. So we've grouped the technologies, and you can further reduce which technologies you might consider for your site by looking at the superscripts following each technology. And what those help you do is make that first screening step to consider your site geology and the LNAPL type. And you can see those that the LNAPL type and geologic indicators are indicated down there in the lower left. So that helps you say, you know, these technologies, for instance, you can see that all of them are really applicable to coarse grain because they have that initial C right here. And there's this C right there. And that means they're really applicable to coarse grain soils. So if you have fine grain soils, like this clay that I've got pictured here, then none of these technologies would apply, and you would screen them all out right at that initial step. So here we are back at our flow chart. And all I want to use this to is indicate that now we've stepped out of using table 6.1, and we're going to look at more the geologic factors in more detail. So again, here's a test pit in this picture showing fine grain soils and a sheen on the groundwater in the test pit. Those fine grain soils are really going to be a complicating factor as you try to select a technology. So really pay attention when that's the case. So on slide 68 here, I'm going to look at some of the A series tables from the appendix. And these are technology specific tables, and they're going to give you information about what sort of geologic factors you should consider when you're thinking about implementing a technology or screening a technology in. So there's the, on the bottom left, there is a picture of the page from the appendix. I've blown up that one line where it says that permeability is going to be important when considering implementing a skimming system. In general, you're going to want to implement skimming systems where the permeability is higher so that you can achieve higher NAPL recovery rates. So then we step out of Section 6 and into Section 7 on slide 69, and we're going to look at evaluation factors. So up to this point in Section 6, we've been looking at the potential effectiveness of a remediation technology. Is it applicable to the type of LNAPL we have? Is it applicable to the type of geology we have? Now in the evaluation factors, we're going to think more broadly about site conditions. Can we implement that technology at the site where we need to implement it? So in Section 7, as we're thinking about the implementability of a technology, we're going to further evaluate those technologies that were screened in Section 6. And hopefully you've got more than one technology coming out of Section 6 that you want to continue to evaluate. If you don't have more than one technology going into Section 7, it's not going to work because Section 7 is based on comparing technologies against each other. So either you're going to skip Section 7 or you want to reevaluate your goals and think about whether there are more technologies that might apply to your site. So Table 7.1 in the main text of the guidance document has the evaluation factors listed. We'll talk about them in a few slides. We're going to select some of those evaluation factors that are important for your site. Maybe there's another evaluation factor that you want to consider for your site that's very important and isn't one of the ones we listed. That's okay. And then go and review the B-series tables for each of those technologies that you have still screened in Appendix A, and that'll help you understand the importance of the different evaluation factors for those particular technologies. So on slide 71, here's an example from Table 7.1 in the main text. So we're just defining here remedial time frame, which might be one of our evaluation factors. And that's just the time that technology is going to take to meet the goal you have set for that technology. Now, the goal you set for that technology may not get you all the way to closure, but it's the goal that gets you to the end of implementing that technology when you should consider some other technology or natural attenuation and natural depletion. So, and then we define basically the impact of the remedial time frame. If everything else is the same, we want to select a technology that's going to get us to those endpoints more quickly. So on slide 72, here's the rest of the basic evaluation factors that we discuss, including remedial time frame, as I just discussed, safety, always an important one, waste stream generation and management, how you're going to deal with what you're pumping out of the ground, whether it's water and LNAPL or soil vapor, or if there's waste that you're generating, say, by injecting something into the ground, if you're changing the geochemistry and solubilizing metals. Are there community concerns? Are there carbon footprint or energy requirements? And I will mention here that there is a green and sustainable guidance document from IPRC. Also, site restrictions, the size of your site and the size of the LNAPL body itself. And then cost is certainly an evaluation factor. It is not explicitly included in the guidance document. And it's because that while cost ranges can be found for LNAPL remediation technologies, they're not included in the tech reg. First, because they're usually broad, because they change with time and they change with regional variability. And second, there are site-specific cost factors that are inherent in the other evaluation factors. Again, I'll say cost is important, and it is inherently an evaluation factor, but by looking at the evaluation factors that are important for your site, we believe that the best cost technology will fall out. So then on slide 73, here's an example from one of the B-series tables in Appendix A. So we're looking at the technology of multi-phase extraction using two pumps. That is both a pump for groundwater and a pump for LNAPL. And looking at a couple of different evaluation factors. So remedial time frame for multi-phase extraction, we believe it will be a moderate time frame to get to your remedial goals. And you might consider what the viscosity of the NAPL is, because more viscous NAPLs will take longer to remove, and even with multi-phase extraction. And then when you look at community concerns, multi-phase extraction are usually pretty complicated systems. There's going to be a lot of noise. There's going to be potential for odors, volatile emissions. So you want to know that you've got the right space to put your above-ground equipment and be able to pipe to the wells. So then here on slide 74, we're back to our flow chart, and we're going to look at what we call the minimum data requirements and critical technology groups, so the C-series tables in Appendix A. And really what that's about is what sort of testing do you want to do on the technologies that you still have retained for evaluation, and how are you going to decide what sort of metrics you're going to use. So again, can't emphasize this enough, fine-grained soils, when you have them at your site, as pictured in this core here, it's going to be very important to test your remedial technology for effectiveness in those type of soils. So just an overview of what you're going to see in section 8. You start with table 8.1, which is a summary of the critical information for each technology. And then you're going to decide whether you want to further evaluate the technology, either through bench scale testing or pilot testing, or some sort of initial size field deployment, which you might use as a large-scale long-term pilot test to help you design the rest of the remedy. You're going to use the C-series tables for final evaluation of the technology or technologies that you have remaining after screening based on sections 6 and 7. And then again, there's going to be that red flag. If you don't have any technologies left, if you've screened all your technologies out in section 6 and 7, then you're not going to do anything in section 8. You need to go back to your LCSM. You need to go back to your objectives and goals and decide if there's another way to frame the problem at the site that can get you to a remedial technology. So here we are in section 8, looking at that a couple rows out of table 8.1. This one's for natural source zone depletion, and it's just a very brief statement of what you might think about doing at different scales to help you understand how natural source zone depletion is working at your site. You might look at just some of the data you already have to do an evaluation of what the rate of natural source zone depletion is. You might look at some bench scale testing, though to be honest, this really isn't done very much anymore, to look at how the NAPL weathers. Pilot scale testing and full scale testing is really where we're at now. We're looking at how to quantify the rate of natural source zone depletion by looking at the carbon dioxide flux off the top of the NAPL as it degrades, or the electron acceptor depletion as the dissolved plume flows away from the NAPL body. So then back to our flow chart here. We've decided what we need to do to assure ourselves that the technology we're selecting is the right one for our problem, and we're getting some design information before you step in and implement the technology, you want to establish goals and metrics specifically to that technology. You want to know what that technology is going to do, how you're going to measure what it's going to do, and how you're going to decide when it has done enough, so that you can demonstrate in the end that those goals were met for that technology, whether or not that got you to closure. It got you to the point where that technology isn't doing you much good anymore, and either need to decide what the next technology is or show that natural attenuation and natural depletion will get you the rest of the way. So that gets us through the stepwise process, the flow chart there. And I'll emphasize again that, you know, this is just a guidance. This is our idea of how you flow through this decision-making process. You know, I love that line from Pirates of the Caribbean about the pirate code. This is not a code. This is a guidance, right? It's just guidelines. We want you to consider all of these things. You don't have to do them exactly in that order every time. But make sure you understand how all those steps contribute to making a decision about a remedial technology. So here we are. We're going to do a quick case study using those guidance steps. Start with a site history and how we developed the LNAPL conceptual site model. We're going to then use the ITRC LNAPL technical and regulatory guidance application, starting from Section 6. And then at this site, we want to focus on mass recovery. So other work was done at the site to decide that no mass control was needed, that the LNAPL body was stable, and that there were no composition concerns. So here we are on slide 79, and this is a former refinery, but that's much bigger than a service station, which is what a lot of us work on. So I think we've got a poll question that can come up now. And just to get a sense from the audience, you know, how many of you work on refineries? How many of you work on service stations? How many of you work on that range going from refineries to service stations? Or maybe you don't work on any of them. So what I'll try to do through the rest of this presentation is just have little asides. You know, this is what was worked on a refinery. How might that be translated for the service station scale? So let's start with the refinery here. 100 years or so ago, the refining processes began here. It achieved a maximum throughput of about 50,000 barrels a day in the mid-70s. So the refinery was closed in the mid-80s and then decommissioned. And the refinery itself covers about 1,200 acres. One thing to note that will become important later is that there is an on-site wastewater treatment plant that has been retained. So that's a facility that we might be able to take advantage of. So it looks like from the poll that about half of the audience there mainly work at the service station scale. Another 25% work, but you know, on that scale all the way from service stations up to maybe the refinery scale. And then just a few of you work wholly at the refinery scale. All right. So we start our process here on slide 80, developing our LNAPL conceptual site model, putting together all the LNAPL characterization data, and identifying our LNAPL concerns. So on slide 81, the first thing that was done was to map out where the NAPL was on this site. Where, you know, and we're talking residual NAPL and mobile NAPL, migrating NAPL if it was present, but there is no migrating NAPL at this site. So we're delineating that smear zone laterally as well as vertically. So what you can see there in that picture is a color flood map showing the vertical extent of the smear zone. So don't confuse this with the thickness of NAPL in wells. So this is the entire thickness, residual and mobile NAPL, in the smear zone. And obviously there's going to be some NAPL in wells through this smear zone. So we used that data where NAPL is found in wells, where there are dissolved phase indicators of NAPL, looking at well logs, for PID results, soil screening results, as well as soil samples that were sent to the laboratory, put all of that information together to develop this map of where we find elm apple at this site. What we come up with is about 200 acres of the site is within this elm apple zone here. On slide 82, the next thing that was done was what's called bale down testing. And this is to assess the transmissivity of the elm apple. So bale down tests were conducted in about 30 to 35 wells at this site to assess the transmissivity where elm apple was mobile enough to flow into the well. And then we use that, map that transmissivity out and use it to, we're going to use it to focus the efforts of elm apple recovery on areas where the transmissivity is above around 1 square foot per day, which is, you know, just a little bit higher than that, the top of the ITRC range that we recommend. Just going to, a quick aside here that the, there are a number of tools that are available now for use for evaluating transmissivity of sites. First, there's an ASTM guide that tells you how to do the tests and also how to analyze the tests. And then there's an API workbook that uses those formulas that come out of the ASTM guide and implements them in a relatively easy to use Excel spreadsheet. And that, there's some guidance that goes along with that to give you a good stepwise process to help you evaluate the bale down test data and estimate a transmissivity. So what about a service station? Are you going to do bale down tests at every service station you come across? Well, you know, I would say bale down testing is almost always useful because it gives you a good view of what the transmissivity at your site is. But transmissivity can be qualitatively evaluated. If good elm apple removal and in-well thickness data are available for your site, you can ask yourself, did the elm apple thickness recover quickly after baling or other short-term recovery efforts, or how long did it take? How much elm apple was recovered in recurring elm apple removal events? Those sort of things can start to give you an idea of how recoverable the elm apple at your site might be. So on slide 83, here's a quick view of the geologic cross-section and where the elm apple is found. So at this site, the top 12 feet are low permeability material. Then there's about 7 feet of coarser grain material, and that's where the groundwater and the elm apple are found. And that's underlined by some more fine grain material. So what you can see there is that we've got a little graphic showing where the elm apple is in the well in green there. Below that's the groundwater. And then over here is a soil core through that sandy layer. So first on the left here, we see a visible light photograph of that core when it's split in half. So you can see that the sandy zone here transitioning into a finer grain zone at the top. And then on the right-hand side is a picture taken with ultraviolet light. And ultraviolet light is useful because most petroleum hydrocarbons fluoresce. If they have any sort of PAHs in them, they're going to fluoresce. And the level of that fluorescence is loosely correlated to how much NAPL is in the pore space. So what you can see here is that at this site, we're finding the NAPL smear zone to be up here in about the upper half of this sand unit, maybe a little bit of NAPL deeper down. And you can see where the UV photography shows very bright white results. That's where the NAPL saturation is going to be the highest. So now we've got a good idea of what the geologic conditions are like at the site and where the elm apple is sitting within that formation. So back to our process flow diagram here, the flow chart. Now we're going to step into the beginning of the technology screening process and start to understand what technologies might be applicable. So we start by saying that our overall objective is to reduce the LNAPL saturation. And more specifically, we want to achieve what we call reducing the LNAPL saturation to the extent practical, right? So then on slide 86 here, what that means is that we want to use LNAPL mass recovery technologies. At this site, we actually kind of stepped out of that exact flow process and said, well, we understand what technologies we have. Let's decide what more information, what additional information we might need to really help us hone in on which technologies are going to be applicable. And then we'll think about more specific site evaluation factors. So we're kind of skipping over to Section 8 and then back to Section 7. So what we're going to do is do some pilot testing at this site in two different areas with similar in-well thicknesses but different NAPL viscosities. And that helps. There's some modeling that was done at this site, so that'll help us refine the parameters used in those modelings, the modeling that we'll then use to predict how quickly remediation will happen at the site. And that'll help us determine what the most efficient and effective technology is going to be. So on slide 87, here we are, highlight all the way across table 6.1, and we get to a number of different technologies that we might consider. We might consider LNAPL skimming. We might consider enhanced fluid recovery, so that's essentially vacuum-enhanced skimming. Dual pump liquid extraction, or total fluid extraction. In this case, we'll use two pumps, so a groundwater pump and an LNAPL skimmer. Or multi-phase extraction, dual pump. Again, this is essentially vacuum-enhanced dual pump liquid extraction. So we've got skimming and dual pump liquid extraction, and then we're putting a vacuum enhancement on both of those. So what about a service station? I mean, this is a lot of testing. But it's warranted because, remember, we've got this 200-acre LNAPL body at the site. At a service station, it's going to be a much smaller NAPL body. We're going to do this type of pilot testing probably much later in the screening process. So then slide 88, here are the two locations where pilot testing was performed. The first view here on the left shows us that the two locations have about the same smear zone thickness, and they, like I said, they had about the same in-well LNAPL thickness. But then on the right over here, when we start to look at where the LNAPL is more and less transmissive, in one location we're going to be testing at a less transmissive area, and in the other we're testing at a more transmissive area. And most of that transmissivity difference has to do with the viscosity of the fuel found in those two areas. So in that one area where it's one centipoise, that's about the viscosity of water. Up in the northern area, 22 centipoise, that's, you know, much closer to diesel or even heavier end fuel, you know, weathered diesel. At a service station, we might choose to only do pilot testing in one area, probably because you only have one type of fuel or it's all mixed together. So why were some of the other technologies screened out? This is kind of a mini Section 7 evaluation here. Multi-phase extraction single pump was screened out. Again, we're going to hopefully take advantage of that on-site wastewater treatment plant. And a single waste stream just isn't compatible with that wastewater treatment plant and process. Water flooding is a possibility, but it's not wouldn't be accepted by the regulator. Bioslurping, we decided that wasn't a good idea because the site is not focused on enhancing aerobic biodegradation. We're really looking to pump mass out of the ground. Excavation, you saw that there was a large amount of overburden, so you have to move a lot of soil before you can actually get to the NAPL impacted zone, so that the costs of that are going to be quite high. And NSCD was screened out just because that's a very long-term process. We want to focus on something that's going to move us to that remedial goal quickly. So what was done for the pilot testing? At each of those two locations, a 6-inch stainless steel well was installed. Stainless steel was used so we could have a bigger slot size and not have any inefficiencies at the well due to the small slots or diameters. And it also takes away any concern we might have that the PVC would swell and then those slots would even get smaller when they come in contact with the elm apple. Continuous soil cores were collected as we were drilling each of those boreholes. That was so we could run those by the lab and get some more information for the models that are applied at this site to help us make decisions about which technologies are going to be most effective. Those are the Van Genuchten and Brooks Corey parameters. Not important that you know what those are, but they are inputs for some of the more complex models you can use for simulating remediation at sites. And then monitoring wells were put in to look at both the radius of influence of the vacuum and the groundwater pumping at various radii around the remediation wells. Here's a picture of the pilot test setup. So you can see the main remediation well there. Got the elm apple drums there in the background, grounded to protect them against any electrical discharge. There's the PVC line onto the well for vacuum, as well as a water discharge line coming from the groundwater pump situated below the elm apple in the well, as well as an elm apple discharge line that's connected to the skimmer. So what are the results of the test? Here on slide 92, we can see that we'll start with just elm apple skimming. That was able to recover about 40 gallons of elm apple over a 72-hour test. And I'll say that this didn't include that initial amount of elm apple in the well. The initial thickness of elm apple in the well was pumped down, and each test was then started from that condition. So we're not looking at that initial elm apple recovery. And then dual pump liquid extraction over that 72 hours was able to do much better. Got out 600 gallons of elm apple in the low viscosity area, I should say. At the high viscosity area, all of these technologies, the skimming and the dual pump liquid extraction, as well as both of those enhanced by vacuum, weren't able to recover any apple at all. Again, after that initial slug of elm apple was pumped out of the well. Interestingly, when vacuum enhancement was added, it didn't increase the amount of elm apple that was able to be recovered. So almost exactly the same amount was recovered when we looked at the enhanced fluid recovery, the vacuum enhanced fluid recovery, and the multi-phase extraction implementations. So why was that? What was going on? So let's go back to our conceptual model. Remember that the groundwater is found in this grab my little pointer here in this coarse grain zone, and the water table is here about a foot and a half below the top of that coarse grain zone. So when the elm apple is just being skimmed or skimmed along with some groundwater extraction, that's pulling this water table down and pulling the elm apple toward the well. But when we add a vacuum to the well, that mounds the groundwater up above this zone and actually pulls it up into the fine-grained overlying area. And what that means is when you put a vacuum on the well, that the only part of the screen that's connected to the formation is up here in the fine-grained area. So we can't do a good job of propagating a vacuum and inducing a lot of airflow through the coarser grain material where the elm apple is found. So again, by returning to our elm apple conceptual site model, we're able to understand what was going on and why vacuum enhancement didn't add benefit. So now we're going to take those two technologies we have, dual pump liquid extraction and skimming, and take a closer look at site-specific evaluation factors. So what evaluation factors were chosen for this site? Remedial time frame is one. Definitely we want the technology that's going to get us to the end point most quickly. Waste stream generation and management is going to be very important. Remember, we've got that on-site wastewater treatment plant, and we want to make sure that our waste stream is compatible with it. And then LMAPL body size, right? We've got a pretty big LMAPL body here. It's about 20 acres that we're going to end up treating in the higher transmissivity area. And then inherently, out of those three factors, we'll be able to consider what the overall cost of the system is going to be. So we start with remedial time frame. So here, I've got it put together a nice little matrix here to help me think about these different evaluation factors for each of the technologies. So we see here remedial time frame for LMAPL skimming. That's probably going to be somewhat of a big concern because skimming, while it's effective, does take a longer time. Whereas we expect dual pump liquid extraction to reach our remedial goals in a shorter time frame, and that's, we can see that because of the amount of NAPL we were able to pump out during that pilot test. So this is, and that's important for cost because it's going to tie in directly to how long we're going to have to spend on O&M on these systems. On slide 97 here, we can see as we predict what's going on with our models, that for skimming, the recovery rate is going to start relatively high here, up around 40 gallons per day that we saw in that initial pilot test. But over time, over 10 years, it's going to gradually decrease to about 10 gallons a day. But we're still producing, you know, quite a bit of LMAPL. And you can see when you plot the cumulative recovery, that while it's slowing down, we really haven't gotten to an asymptotic point even after 10 years. On the other hand, you look here at dual pump liquid extraction, and when you run the models for that, you can see that very quickly, and we start up here, again, around that 600 gallons per day that we saw in the pilot test, and quickly fall within just a few years to an asymptotically low recovery rate. And again, you can see the cumulative curve here. We achieve 90% of the recoverable LMAPL. We're able to remove 90% of the recoverable LMAPL within just 1.15 years. So the next evaluation factor is waste management. LMAPL skimming, that's going to be pretty good in terms of waste management because really, if you're operating that system right, you're only recovering LMAPL. You're recovering very little groundwater, which means that the volume of waste you need to treat is going to be very low. On the other hand, dual pump liquid extraction is going to produce a lot of groundwater, so we need to be able to handle that groundwater. Really, the good factor at this site is that we have our own wastewater treatment plant. So while there is an additional cost to treat all that groundwater, the additional cost really just comes down to the cost of pumping the groundwater to the treatment plant and through the treatment plant. So finally, we look at LMAPL body size, and this comes down to what's our expected radius of influence around these different remedial technologies. For skimming, we don't expect a very large radius of influence around a skimmer well, so we're going to have to put in likely more skimmer wells to treat the same area, whereas with a dual pump liquid extraction system, we're able to influence a larger area because we're using the groundwater flow to help push the LMAPL, pull the LMAPL toward the remediation well, so we can put fewer dual pump liquid extraction wells in. So here I've put all of these factors on a simple table so that we can understand how they balance out. So for LMAPL skimming, it really only has an advantage or not a disadvantage when you look at LMAPL body size. LMAPL skimming wells are going to be less expensive or about the same expense as the dual pump liquid extraction wells, well network. While we have to put in more wells, more skimming wells, they will be cheaper to operate. So overall, that kind of that initial cost is going to be about the same whether we put in one system or the other. But then, as we showed in the last few slides, dual pump liquid extraction really has an advantage over skimming when we think about remedial time frame and waste management. And that's driven because we have that on-site wastewater treatment plant. So by using these evaluation factors, DPLE is the technology that seems to be favored at this site, at this large refinery site. But what about a service station? You know, a service station isn't going to have its own wastewater treatment plant. So all of a sudden, the advantage will probably swing to LMAPL skimming, in particular because of that waste management. You know, you're going to have, again, much lower volume of waste to deal with. So that's why LMAPL skimming is going to be more advantageous. And the LMAPL body size at a service station is likely to be much smaller. So where you got that efficiency of scale, because we're trying to treat a 20-acre body, LMAPL body at the refinery, and we can really balance out the costs of more LMAPL skimming wells and fewer but more complicated dual pump liquid extraction wells. At a service station, you're probably only going to put in a few skimming wells anyway. So you'd only end up maybe in the end with one dual pump liquid extraction well, and you don't get that same efficiency of scale. So again, biasing toward LMAPL skimming for this type of a situation at a service station. So the last step, as we're thinking about this, is what are those minimum data requirements that we want to implement, and what are the metrics and goals, endpoints that we're going to look at for this technology. And that's, again, in Section 8. You can go in the C-Series tables here. I've pulled out one of the rows in the C-Series tables for dual pump liquid extraction. And one of the important design factors that you want to consider that's going to help you design what your well spacing is what's the groundwater radius of capture? How effective are you at making groundwater flow toward your extraction well, again, to help pull the LMAPL toward that extraction well? And that's really going to be critical to understanding how many dual pump liquid extraction wells you need and what their spacing is. So again, those C-Series tables are where we find that site-specific data for evaluating and designing a technology. And then for other technologies other than dual pump liquid extraction, there's information in there about what sort of bench and pilot scale testing you might consider. So with that, we're getting pretty close to the end here. I'll just wrap up by saying that LMAPL remediation and deciding what technology you want to use for LMAPL remediation is an iterative process. At any step in that flow diagram we have there, you can always circle back to the previous step or two previous steps back. In fact, I've got a new version of that flow chart that I've been using myself, and I've explicitly put in those loopbacks. At any point, ask the critical questions about what you're doing. Do you have enough information? And if you don't, go back and develop. You know, identify those data gaps, fill them, and then step into the process again. And the advantage of using a flowchart like this is that it gives you a tool to help all stakeholders communicate about where you are in the decision process for a site and how you reached certain decisions. And that way, you can really lay it out for everybody how you came to decide that, you know, this technology is the one that is best for this site. So using the technical and regulatory guidance for LNAPL that we've provided gives you that one framework for selecting those technologies. Like I said, you can mix and match that framework a little bit, but you know, make sure you're going through all of those steps, whatever order you take them in. And then I gave you that nice case study that kind of showed how I mostly used the stepwise process, but there were a few places where I said, you know, I want to step outside the process and skip ahead a little bit. So here we are at the end. Hopefully you were able to attend, and I think I saw that a number of you did attend parts one and two. And with today's training, part three, hopefully you've got a good idea of what the science about LNAPL behavior is, how to develop an LNAPL conceptual site model, what sort of characterization you need to do to develop that LNAPL conceptual site model, and then today using that information to understand what the concerns are for a site and how to get objectives and goals from those concerns, and then use that to select the appropriate remedial technology for your site and your objectives and goals. So there has been, I think as Eric said at the beginning, LNAPL's classroom training that was being conducted. It's possible that will be revamped after the current guidance revision is issued. And then, like Eric said again at the beginning, that there's a team, we're working on revising this guidance document. So there'll be an update, and look at the website to see when that guidance will be coming out. I think that gets me to the end.
Thanks, Rick. We do have time to answer a few questions, so you're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A box in the bottom right. I also have a couple more poll questions for you to answer as we're wrapping up today. Before we get to those questions and answers, I do want to point out our links to additional resources. So we have pulled together quite a few different resources, including links back to that part one and part two. So if you want to listen to archives of part one and part two, or even just download the presentations, they are all available there on that links to additional resources page. Also, the feedback form. We do ask that everyone on the call today take just a few minutes to give us your feedback. This is a great time for you to give us feedback because we are working on new classes, and we can incorporate your comments as we're developing those new courses. It's also your opportunity to create a participation certificate. So if that's something you want, the way to get that is through the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom that says you certify you attended. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box. Once you submit, the system is going to generate that certificate for you. So right now the only way is through this feedback form. We have had a couple of questions that have come in. When you talk about wells, are you talking about drinking water wells?
When I was talking about wells, I was talking mostly about groundwater monitoring and remediation wells. Drinking water wells would be an example of a compliance point where, you know, that might be a specific statement, a metric that you want to evaluate for your technology. Are we protecting local groundwater, local drinking water wells?
For geology factors, what should we use instead of grain size for fractured flow dominated aquifers?
Fractured flow is a very tough, they're complex sites. So understanding the fracture apertures and the fracture density is a good start. That would be analogous to grain size. I'll say in the new LNAPL update, there is going to be an appendix about LNAPL at fractured rock sites. And I know there's also a whole guidance about fractured remediation at fractured rock sites in general that will be coming out.
And the ITRC Fractured Rock Guidance and Associated Training will be coming out towards the end of this year and early next year. How does the guidance recommend on how to address community concerns by providing clear, timely public review processes?
It doesn't really touch on that. I don't know if there's an ITRC guidance about that, but I know there's certainly EPA guidance on how to engage the community.
And this is Juliana, and I know that ITRC's guidance on petroleum vapor intrusion does have some templates and a great resource on community concern. So if vapor intrusion is kind of the focus there, that petroleum vapor intrusion guidance from ITRC is a great resource.
So, and I'll just clarify, when we're talking about community concerns when evaluating remedial technologies, what we're talking about is, are you installing a system close to residences or businesses that might be sensitive to noise, and is it going to be a noisy system? So you might bias your selection toward less noisy systems in that case.
Do you recommend getting regulatory agencies involved early on to get buy-in on goals and endpoints?
I'd say absolutely. The more everyone is on the same page at every step of the process, I think the more successful you're going to be at getting to the end of remediation and deciding together that that's all you can do at the site, and that natural attenuation and natural depletion will take care of the rest of it.
Looking at our poll results, would you recommend using the LMAPL remedial technology selection framework described today? So we have almost everyone who is ready to recommend using this framework. And then thinking about projects you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? And you're welcome to scroll through to see the answers that others have submitted for that question, as well as enter your own answer to that question as well. How would the selection of remedial technologies change if the source of LMAPL were unknown or potentially ongoing?
Well, you can use information that doesn't necessarily have to come from knowing the source in order to choose a remedy. So if you can do testing of the NAPL itself to understand what it is, you can look at the composition of the NAPL itself or the soil. So you don't, in that case, you wouldn't have to know where it came from per se. Certainly, that's an important piece of information because it's going to help you understand what the potential lateral extent of the LMAPL is, and it will certainly let you know early on what kind of NAPL to expect. For an ongoing release, I think almost everybody would say that you really need to focus your initial efforts on stopping that ongoing release.
If I could add a little bit, I would generally say that that's sort of a conceptual site model question that, you know, should be asked early on. And if it's not understood early on, you know, we should really seek to identify that answer. Of course, as Rick identified, remediation activities can occur when we have immediate concerns that we're addressing. If you have explosive conditions, you're going to address that right away. But if you have more long-term concerns or concerns that relate to the migration potential of the NAPL, and we have existing sources at, you know, the facility, we should really seek to answer those questions to kind of tighten up that conceptual site model, because that will really aid in fully understanding what are the concerns that are present.
Can groundwater flow carry NAPL below residual levels and result in sheening?
So it's complicated. No groundwater flow won't. If Napola is residual, that means it can't move. And under natural conditions, maybe you can make it move by sending it to a laboratory and spinning it at 1,000 times gravity. But under natural conditions, the residual L-Napola is not going to flow and sheen. Now it gets complicated because if the L-Napola is in close enough proximity to the surface water body and the top of the capillary fringe is just in the right place, you can essentially get sheens that develop along the top of the capillary fringe and then emanate into surface water.
Thank you.